for the first case, Integrity Global Security versus Dell Marketing.
Good morning, Your Honor. I am Frank Meredith, and I am going to be presenting on behalf of Integrity Global Security and Green Hill Software.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith.
Your Honor, I'm Kim Brightwell, here on behalf of the Appellate.
Mr. Brightwell, thank you. We'll go ahead and call the second case as well, Harris County Hospital District versus PUC.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kyle Hawkins for the PUC.
Mr. Hawkins.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gavin Loreal for AT&T.
Good morning, sir.
Susan Hayes for Harris County Hospital District.
Good morning, Ms. Hayes. And we will probably take a brief break between the cases, given that you all have a complicated time split to give the clerk the time to set the clock for you and everything. For those of you new to the third court, each side is allowed 20 minutes to argue. Generally, we'll reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I understand we have some different time allotments in the second case that we'll take care of. We have a time warning system up here. When you see the yellow light, that means you have 2 minutes remaining in whichever time is allotted. When you see the red light, that means that your time is out. And if you would please observe that. We will be recording the arguments today, and the recording will be available for you to download off of the court's website probably within 24 hours. Also have a group of Westlake seniors for Career Day who I think are going to join us, so we're glad to have them here. By way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might disturb our litigants, now would be a good time to turn that off. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys in IGS. Mr. Meredith.
Thank you, Robert. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Yes, sir. I think we have that down.
Thank you. May it please the court, by way of introduction, there are four matters that I plan to address. I will list them now and come back to discuss them in more detail later. Each of these reasons or matters is alone sufficient for reversal of the summary judgment. The first issue is that this is a breach of contract action in which the amended Global Alliance Agreement and the Third Amendment are unambiguous and clearly define the duties and obligations of the parties. The integration clause and in the contracts and Delaware and Texas parole evidence rules bar the type of parole evidence that Dell offered in the trial court. The second issue is that if the agreements are ambiguous, as Dell has urged, IGS has offered declarations and deposition testimony which clearly demonstrate that there are genuine issues of disputed fact. Dell's suspension and pay and refusal to pay under the contracts. In reviewing the evidence, the court must take the evidence most favorable to IGS as true and indulge in every favorable inference in favor of IGS in its de novo review. Third, Dell admits in the opposition brief that Texas precedent required the trial court to apply Texas procedural law. Using the Texas 4-year statute of limitations, IGS filing in the federal court in August of 2015 and refiling in the district court in January 2016 were both within the statute of limitations for Dell's breaches. Fourth, the court refused to consider the filing of an amended complaint based upon newly discovered factual issues, which would supplement IGS's declarations and deposition testimony and demonstrate additional disputed issues of material fact, and it was an abuse of discretion to refuse to consider the amended complaint or hold a hearing with respect to the amended complaint.
There seem to be a number of those complaints about rulings or lack of rulings from the trial court. So as you go along, if you would kind of clarify for us which things might have been overruled as a matter of law or somehow implied and which ones just clearly had no response from the trial court.
I'll be happy to do that, Your Honor. Or I could summarize it now if that would.
I don't want to interrupt your flow, whatever works best for you.
All right. Well, I think just for starters, in connection with the proceeding below, there were objections that were filed in connection with the opposition to the motion for summary judgment raising a number of evidentiary issues, primarily the parole evidence rule, but also a number of other objections based upon supposition, lack of foundation, and so forth. On two occasions, we brought to the, at the hearing, we requested that the court rule. On two additional occasions, we requested that the court rule. We finally filed a motion requesting a hearing on the objections, and the court refused to set the hearing. I believe under Texas law, particularly the law of this jurisdiction, it is not an option in a summary judgment motion to assume that by granting the motion, the objections were denied. So I think they had to have been ruled on. I think it was error not to rule on them. The unfortunate solution is that I think when you, if you, in your de novo review, you're going to have to address those evidentiary issues because the court did not address them. That's the first. The second is with respect to the motion for new trial. I agree that the court was not required to hold a hearing and could simply deny that motion by not hearing it, which is what happened. The third issue relates to filing the amended complaint. There was a motion filed to file an amended complaint. That motion was set for hearing before another judge by happenstance. That judge deferred to the trial court. The trial court would not set a hearing, but it was later than the ruling, and the court went forward, ruled, did not address the motion to amend. And our contention is that was an abuse of discretion. So those are the three instances.
Thank you.
So let me address the first issue, which has to do with the contracts. The timing of these various contracts is important because it affects what's parole evidence and what's not parole evidence, and it also affects the issues with respect to the statute of limitations. There's a detailed timeline that's attached as Exhibit 34 to IGS's motion for summary judgment. In summary, the times that are important are relate to the third amendment, which is dated January 7, 2011, the suspension letter that was sent by Dell, which is dated August 11, 2011, and the date for notice to terminate on 30 days notice without cause is October 28, 2011. And the Third Amendment provides that during the period of what's referred to as the on-hold time frame, which starts on January 7, 2011 and runs through October 28, 2011, Dell had no right to terminate either agreement, the Third Amendment or the amended Global Alliance Agreement during that time frame. It's our position that the amended and restated Global Alliance Agreement expressly supersedes the Global Alliance Agreement, that's section 11.7 of that agreement, and it contains an integration clause in section 11.8. None of Dell's witnesses testified in the declarations or the deposition excerpts that they believe the agreements to be ambiguous. All of the IGS witnesses and a number of Dell witnesses who were deposed testified that the agreements were unambiguous. Under those circumstances, the parole evidence rule and the integration clause of the agreements would apply and would preclude parole evidence. The only people who find that the agreements were ambiguous are Dell's lawyers, but they can't provide summary judgment evidence. It's up to the court to determine whether the agreements are ambiguous. Until that determination is made and it is determined the type of evidence that has to be received, parole evidence cannot be considered. The essence of Dell's defense on the $9 million claim for payment of minimum conditional license fees are that Dell suspended the payments by the August 11 letter and thereafter terminated the agreement without cause on November 30, 2011, which left IGS without a remedy to collect the MLCs that accumulated during the on-hold time frame. So the way the Third Amendment worked was that in exchange for top secret exclusivity, Dell would agree to pay minimum license commitments that would that amounted to $3,750 every quarter. In the Third Amendment, $2 million for each quarter was deferred for a period of 1 year. Dell contends that that there was no deferral and that, in fact, those payments were new MCLs and therefore MLCs, and therefore they did not have to be paid because of the termination of the contract. We disagree with that, and in fact, Section 5 of the Third Amendment states, no later than 12 months after the on-hold time frame expires or is terminated, and it expired October 28, 2011, Dell shall pay to IGS the difference between the MCL payments for each period during the on-hold time frame set forth in Table 2 and the MLC payments actually made by Dell to IGS during the on-hold time frame.
Is that how we sort of, one of the logical leaps here is how this October 28, 2011 time frame where Dell can terminate, I guess, without cause or for no reason.
Correct.
And then you have this MCL payment that's a year later.
I mean, yes.
Is that how you justify that MCL payment still being due even though the contract's been terminated?
No, I that's not the way I view it. I view it that the MLC payments that were deferred were earned during that period of time. Because during the on-hold time frame, Dell received top secret or kept or had top secret exclusivity, which is what the MCL payments were for. And in addition, during that on-hold time frame, IGS made three material deliveries with respect to software and with respect to applications for the disk, the product that was being developed, which ultimately was submitted to the Department of, or the Defense Intelligence Agency, and was given PL4 certification in March of 2012. So the agreement specifically says in paragraph 5 that there will be minimum payments made of $1.75 million during each quarter of the on-hold time frame, rather than the $3,175,000, and that $2 million would be deferred for 1 year after the date the on-hold time period expired. And Section 5 makes that very clear that these are not new payments, because it cites to Table 2, which is the table that sets forth the MLC payments, and says they will be payable in 1 year. The key to that, in our view, is that these $9 million in payments are not barred by the statute of limitations. Case law in Texas makes it clear that if there's an attempt to repudiate an agreement, that is, if the August 11, 2011 letter were deemed to be a repudiation, we say it's not, but if it were, the party, the innocent party, the non-breaching party, can elect either to accept the repudiation or reject it and continue to perform. And it's the latter that happened in this case. That is, IGS continued to perform, continued to make deliveries as were required, and Dell encouraged IGS to do that. That being the case, IGS could wait until it was time to pay before the action would accrue.
Is there a fact issue or dispute between the parties as to what it means to have top secret exclusivity, given that the product was never able to achieve the security clearances that the parties had hoped it would?
I don't think so. I mean, it may be they would argue that's the case, but no, because the exclusivity is that IGS will not go to anybody else and attempt to develop the same product using the same software and the same product. So it's not, so they couldn't go to HP or some other hardware provider and try to sell the disk software product using the computers of that other competitor. So the exclusivity, and it's very clear in the agreement, the exclusivity is to preclude IGS from going to a third party and competing. So that is what was paid for.
Regardless of whether the deliverable ever actually functions.
Correct, because throughout this entire period, even though the product was under development, and eventually there were a lot of modifications that were required for a number of reasons that probably are parole evidence, but there were a lot of modifications that were required, it was clear that the product was not going to be completed and ready for sale until the on-hold time frame expired, because the three deliverables that were required had to do with new software that was required by NAISC, who was the new host and the new customer that was going to get the certification, and it required upgrades to a new model of computer that Dell was then bringing onto line. So, as of the beginning of the on-hold time frame, there was not a product ready to sell or even ready to present to the DIA to certify, because they were making changes in the software. At the end of that time period, they had delivered all of the items that were required, and those products were delivered to NAISC, which was the sponsor. It in turn submitted all of the paperwork and the product to DIA, who ultimately approved it in March of 2012. But until it was approved, there wasn't a product that could be readily sold. It certainly wasn't a product that could be sold as top secret PL4 compliant. But my client, during this entire period, whether it was in a nascent form or whether it was in a completed form, could not present to anybody else.
Okay.
I think I see the red light, so.
Thank you, Ms. Meredith. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, Mr. Brightwell.
Morning. May it please the court.
We picked a thriller for our law students or our students back there. We may be stemming the tide of law school applicants if we're not careful this morning. Yes, sir.
I will start my argument with the issue of rulings or lack of rulings by the trial court. It is true that the IGS filed 49, I believe, objections to evidence. All of those objections and all of that evidence related to a ground for summary judgment that we withdrew. We withdrew that, and so there was no reason for the court to rule on those objections because none of that evidence related to the grounds on which we went forward. Mr. Meredith agreed that the motion for new trial was properly overruled by operation of law. Well, not that it was properly overruled, but that it was overruled by operation of law. As to the amended complaint, we have cited in our briefs there was no express ruling on their motion to amend their complaint, a motion which came after the summary judgment hearing. But under the law, under the clear law in Texas, this court is to deem that motion to amend was overruled. We have cited a number of cases. I think the one that is most similar to the case we have here today is the Austin versus Countrywide case out of the Houston Court of Appeals in 2008. And in that case, the plaintiff filed a motion to amend his pleadings 5 days after the trial, or in that case, the trial was also a summary judgment hearing. Later on that same day, the trial court granted the summary judgment against the plaintiff without expressly ruling on the motion to amend the complaint. The Court of Appeals in Houston said, under these facts, the court is to presume that the trial court denied the motion to amend. The court went on also to assess whether or not that denial of the motion to amend was within the trial court's discretion. And the court took into account the situation, the timing of the filing, that it occurred 5 days after the trial, or in that case, a summary judgment hearing. The court also looked at whether the plaintiff, in using due diligence, could have filed that motion to amend earlier, prior to the summary judgment hearing. The court, in looking at it, found yes, the plaintiff could have filed that earlier using due diligence, and so used that as the basis to say that the trial court was within its discretion to deny the motion to amend the pleadings. The facts we have here are much stronger in support of the trial court's discretion in denying this motion to amend. In this case, after a year of discovery, when Dell moved for summary judgment, there was no claim by IGS that, well, now wait a minute, this is a little premature, we have some more discovery we need to take. No effort to take additional discovery before the hearing, no request to delay the summary judgment hearing. To the contrary, IGS announced fully ready to go forward with a final summary judgment hearing. It wasn't until after that hearing was held, at which point I would suggest the writing was pretty clearly on the wall that they were at serious risk of losing their claims. It wasn't until then that they started to work to find a way to stop the judge from ruling on summary judgment. Under those facts, the trial court is fully within her discretion to deny the motion to amend. In addition to the timing and the diligence issues, we have shown that this proposed amended pleading was prejudicial on its face. It added a new claim, a new cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, something that was not in their pleadings throughout the year of discovery, something we didn't have a chance to ask their witnesses about on, you know, how does this work, what damages might have flowed from it. That is the classic definition under Texas law of a pleading that's prejudicial on its face, and that too supports the trial court's discretion to deny a motion to amend the pleadings. Now, before I leave this topic, I would say, regardless of how the court rules on the discretion issue, this would not undermine the court's ruling on the summary judgment record and granting summary judgment. It might affect whether it's a final summary judgment order, but it wouldn't affect the summary judgment that the court rendered. In going back to the issues on summary judgment, I think it would be helpful to look at exactly what IGS pleaded as breach of contract. And that's reflected on our oral argument exhibit number 2 behind tab 2 of that argument, of that exhibit. IGS asserted that Dell breached its contract by failing to make 3 specific MLC payments. There was totaling $9 million, a $1.75, a $1.25, a $6 million MLC payment. And then IGS also claimed that Dell's breaches resulted in other damages beyond this $9 million, but they weren't specific about that. Addressing that other damages issue, Dell, after discovery, moved for summary judgment against all of these claims. The trial court granted that motion, and the record supports it, and the trial court's summary judgment should be affirmed on appeal. As to the other damages claim, the summary judgment record is extremely clear and undisputed that the only recoverable damages were the 3 MLC payments totaling $9 million. And that evidence came out of the mouths of the corporate representative that IGS designated expressly for the purpose to testify about their damages. And IGS, in this court, on their reply brief, did not even address this issue. Moving on to the $6 million MLC payment that they claim. The summary judgment record contained, and by the way, we made no argument on the grounds that we went forward with on summary judgment, that there's any ambiguity in the contract. We relied on the contract to support our summary judgment. And two contractual provisions make it clear that the court's ruling on this $6 million MLC was correct. Section 1.2.1 of the party's agreement absolutely gives Dell the right to terminate the agreement without cause for convenience effective November 30th of 2011. The second provision, section 1.2.3, says that upon exercising that right and terminating the contract, Dell's obligation to make MLC payments terminates. Dell put on evidence that it exercised its right to terminate on November 30th of 2011. And the testimony from the IGS that's part of the summary judgment record says that IGS has no basis to disagree that Dell had terminated the contract. Under these facts, on this record, it is absolutely the right decision that when Dell terminated the contract in November of 2011, that the $6 million MLC payment, which was not due until a year later, was terminated under the unambiguous terms of the contract.
Is that the best contractual provision we have to kind of tell us what the nature of that MLC was? I know I'm saying MCL or MLC, but.
It's MLC, Your Honor. It's minimum license commitment. What it is Dell committed to make a series of payments. IGS gave Dell the exclusive right to market the joint product.
I mean, specifically the $6 million one that seems to be hanging out there after the termination of the contract.
Yes, well, there were a number of MLC payments that were scheduled to be paid after the termination of the contract. And IGS acknowledges that they had no right to pursue those. They don't even mention those in their complaint. They want to treat the $6 million claim differently, even though it's due later than many of the other ones that they didn't even claim. They want to say, well, it's due, you still owe that, because even though it wasn't due till here, we earned it back before you terminated the contract. The problem with that argument is there is no evidence to support it. You go back and look at the contract, and it contains nothing in it about IGS earning any MLC payment, much less this $6 million MLC payment, before its due date.
Is that because the $6 million was amounts that were deferred during the period of this on-hold period?
Your Honor, there is the word deferred I would take issue with, because what the contract does is the parties, Dell had a right to terminate in January of 2011 before the amendment took place, and the product was not top secret certified, and so this thing was about to be over with. And the party said, well, wait, let's create an on-hold time frame, and we'll go through this a little further to see if we can get this thing top secret certified. So they created this 3-month time period. And what they changed by amendment was to say, all right, these payments are not going to be $3.75 million per quarter. They're going to be $1.75 million per quarter. So that if we go through this period and we don't get top secret certified, Dell's not having to come out with the full amount. If, however, we go through and we get top secret certified and everybody's blowing and going and loving the thing, and we keep going till a year from later from now, you're still going to get this money. It's nothing about deferral. It's about changing what Dell has to pay and making an additional payment that gets paid if we make it to that point. There's nothing about you're going to pay it anyway. And Mr. Meredith brings up the idea that, well, we created deliverables during that time period, and you got exclusivity, Dell, during that time period. That's true. But IGS got paid for that. They got paid $1.75 million per quarter for that amount. Now, Dell, when it makes an MLC payment, it is purchasing prepaid licenses. So that when it makes a $1.75 million MLC payment, that's the MLC stands for minimum license commitment, a commitment to purchase these licenses. And so Dell is making these payments and acquiring licenses to the IGS software so that Dell can then resell that with the product that they market. There is nothing in the record to suggest that Dell got $6 million worth of additional prepaid licenses before the contract was terminated, because that did not happen. And so the notion that somehow Dell got that IGS earned that $6 million or gave minimum licenses to Dell before the termination is wrong, and it is not in the record. Let me speak briefly on the $1.75 and $1.25 million payments. Dell moved for summary judgment against these payments on the grounds of that they're barred by the statute of limitations. The trial court granted that motion, but did not specify whether the trial court was relying on the Delaware 3-year statute of limitations or the Texas 4-year statute of limitations. Now, we believe the correct statute to apply is the Delaware statute, because the parties in their contract expressly agreed and expressed their intent that their choice of Delaware law should apply, should include the Delaware statute of limitations. This is section 11.2 of the contract. And in that section 11.2, the parties first say Delaware law is going to govern disputes like this, disputes over performance versus breach. But the parties don't stop there. The parties go on and say, if IGS initiates the lawsuit, they have to do it in Texas, where Dell is headquartered. If Dell initiates lawsuit, they have to do it in California, where IGS is headquartered. The only reasonable interpretation of combining those sentences with the previous choice of law sentence is that the parties intended for their Delaware choice of law to include the statute of limitations. Otherwise, you end up with an unreasonable interpretation and an unreasonable result under the contract that IGS gets 4 years to sue Dell for promissory estoppel, but Dell only gets 2 years to sue IGS. That's an unreasonable result and would violate fundamental contract construction principles.
What about body of law that generally the statute of limitations is a procedural rule that you take of the state where venue is rather than the choice of law provision?
Yeah, that comes into play, Your Honor, if you get into a choice of law analysis. If you interpret the contract the way we believe it must be to be reasonable, you don't have to get into a choice of law analysis because you're determining that the parties by contract wanted and agreed to have the Delaware statute of limitations apply to their claim. And Texas expressly permits, we've cited the statute, Texas permits contracting parties to agree to change the statute of limitations. So if you interpret the contract the way we believe a reasonable interpretation requires, you don't have to get into choice of law.
Does that selection of statute of limitations require some specificity beyond what you seem to have here in 11.2?
It does not, Your Honor. There is not a, and I'm referring to section 16.070 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which says parties can contract to change the statute of limitations, but not down below 2 years. It doesn't say anything about do you have to do this specifically with particular words, or does your contract just have to reflect that that was your intent? We have also cited 271.005, which says it'll even permit parties in certain contracts to do an agreement that's contrary to Texas public policy. That one has a little bit more of a suggestion that if you're going to rely on that, you need more specific language, but not the Civil Practice and Remedies Code.
But Mr. Brightwell, you would agree that if Texas law applies, then the $6 million October 2012 payment would not be barred by the statute?
That's correct, Your Honor. But as I've discussed, we think the $6 million payment is barred on the merits under the unambiguous contract. Delaware, if you apply the Delaware 3-year, all of their claims are barred. If you apply the Texas 4-year statute of limitations, the $6 million and the other damages, the summary judgment should be upheld on the merits, but the limitations would still bar the 1.75 and 1.25 because their case was filed in Travis County in January of 2016, more than 4 years after their claims arose. Now, they try to rely on the tolling statute in Texas to say they filed an action in federal court where there was no jurisdiction in August, which would be within 4 years. And they say that the tolling statute allows them to count that and get under the Texas four-year statute of limitations. But that tolling statute will not protect a plaintiff if the plaintiff's first filing was made with intentional disregard of proper jurisdiction, an argument that we raised in our motion for summary judgment. And the dispute between the parties on appeal here seems to be on who has the burden of proof when that question of was the first filing filed with intentional disregard of proper jurisdiction. Because IGS makes the argument that, well, Dell's evidence of intentional disregard was circumstantial at best and doesn't say anything about what was really in our head when we filed it. And so they say, so Dell, there's a fact question because Dell didn't meet their burden of proof. Problem is they got the burden of proof exactly backwards. We have a Texas Supreme Court case that expressly answered this question. It's the In Re USAA case of 2010. And that was a situation where the defendant raised intentional disregard, and the Supreme Court says, we've never talked about how you deal with this issue on a summary judgment setting, so we're going to tell you now. And even though the statute says that the defendant needs to show that the first filing was with intentional disregard, what the Supreme Court says is what we're telling you is if the defendant raises that issue, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to come forward and show what was in their head and show that they did not make the initial filing with intentional disregard for proper jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court says the reason we're shifting the burden is because the plaintiff is the one who knows. In this case, the plaintiffs did not come forward with any affidavit test or other type of evidence showing whether the reason they filed was because, well, let's take a shot. We'd prefer federal court, and even though we might not have jurisdiction, let's take a shot. Or whether it was a mistake, which we just don't know, because they did not put anything in the summary judgment record. They did not meet their burden. And so they cannot rely on the tolling statute.
Does that mean we're left with at least circumstantial evidence on that, based on the fact that they did file in federal court here and that you've got some contract provisions that seem to anticipate that being a potential proper venue?
No, Your Honor. The contractual provisions say you file here, but it is limited on it's expressly in the contractual provision if the court is a court of competent jurisdiction. So there's no inferential basis there. Moreover, what the Supreme Court said is what we're looking for is what was the reason for their filing. We need evidence from the plaintiff as to why they made this filing there and whether it was intentional disregard or not. Failing that burden, they do not get to rely on the tolling provision. We believe that the trial court's summary judgment is supported by the summary judgment record and should be affirmed on appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Brightwell. Mr. Meredith, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the answers to the questions that you've asked about which some parole evidence has been expressed all are really answered in the contracts themselves. So you asked, is there a place where we could look to understand exactly what these MLC payments are? And the answer to that is yes. There are two references that I would like to give the court. The first is to Section 2 of the amended Global Alliance Agreement, and specifically paragraph 2.2.3, which describes the payments and sets forth Table 2, which was never amended, never changed, and which is referred to in paragraph 5 of the Third Amendment. So what the MLC payments are, which was never changed and never amended, is in paragraph 2.2.3. with respect to what describes the circumstances of the payments that are to be made is very clearly specified in paragraphs 4 and 5 of the Third Amendment. And that section provides that during the on-hold time frame, the $1,750,000 will be paid each quarter. And then paragraph 5 says, each $1,750,000 MLC payment during the on-hold time frame is $2 million less than the $3,750,000 payment listed in paragraph 2 for periods 3, 4, and 5, or $6 million for the entire on-hold time frame. No later than 12 months after the on-hold time frame expires or is terminated, Dell shall pay IGS the difference between the MLC payments for each period during the on-hold time frame set forth in paragraph in table 2 and the MLC payments actually made. So that total is $900,000, not $600,000, because they did not pay the $1,075,000 for each of the two quarters after the August 11 letter. So I think that's very clear. The other thing that is important in reading that is to refer to the Global Alliance Agreement, paragraph 11, or section 11.12, which reads, the obligations of the parties under sections 1.1.3 and 6 through 11, which aren't applicable, and the obligation to pay amounts due hereunder shall survive expiration or termination of the agreement and shall continue in full force and effect thereafter. So those are four specific references which state that the MLC payments are alive and should be paid. But the other thing,
Mr. Meredith, what about section 1.2.3 of the restated amended Global Alliance Agreement that Mr. Brightwell cited? Upon the occurrence of either a subsection 1.21 or 1.22 termination event, Dell's MLC shall terminate.
That's true with respect to future MLCs. I agree with that. But that addresses only future MLCs. Okay. If I could, I'll just cover a couple other issues very quickly. There was an argument made that the amended proposed amended complaint included a new cause of action. It does not.
I would refer you to the record starting at page 633, and it sets forth a black line of the amended complaint, and it does not include a cause of action for bad faith breach of contract, which is what was stated. On choice of law, the choice of law under the contracts is very clear. It says the choice of law regarding the validity of the agreement, the enforceability of the agreement, and the terms of and the performance of the agreement are covered, are to be governed by Delaware law. That's a standard choice of law provision for the application of the substantive law of the state of Delaware. There's nothing that says that Delaware procedural law will apply. It can't be implied from anything that's said. The Texas rule has been consistent and requires that Texas procedural law, including the statute of limitations, be applied when there's a choice of law. My time's up, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith. Mr. Brightwell, fine arguments on a complex case. Case will be submitted and you all can be excused. We're going to take a brief recess, but the court will go ahead and call and have the attorneys come up in 3-17-00811, Harris County Hospital District versus PUC et al. The court will stand a brief recess.
All right.